Thank you for listening to this audio recording from LimoPlanet 2020 Free the Future. The following talk was presented at LimoPlanet, the Free Software Foundation's annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology. For more information on LimoPlanet, visit limoplanet.org/conference. LimoPlanet is a live conference with speakers who often use visual slides in their presentations. We have only selected talks for this audio feed that do not overly rely on visuals, but if you would like to see a speaker's slides, they are available at media.limoplanet.org. LimoPlanet speakers do not represent the Free Software Foundation. As part of our mission to show how important free software is to everyone, we have speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedoms of all computer users, LimoPlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals who, like you, donate what they can. To keep this work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss.
Hello, Libra Planet! How are you doing? My name is William Paul Liggett, and I am going to be teaching you today about how to teach students about free software. No, but it will not be about how to find software for $0. Instead, this is about free software licenses versus proprietary licenses, and what that even means for free software projects and so forth. But before we get into all of that, there are some fundamentals that you should probably understand because they get brought up quite often, such as copyright, patents, and trademarks. And then eventually, we tie this all back together into software licenses. All right, so let's begin. But actually, before we do, I'm a big fan of really, really good jokes. All right, are you ready? Okay. What did the fast tomato say to the slow tomato? Ketchup! Yes, I know it's quite terrible, but it makes me laugh. And it's okay, you can laugh too. All right. So, as I mentioned, this talk is about how to teach students about free software. So, as I mentioned, my name is William Paul Liggett, and speaking at LibraPlanet 2020. The junk text aspect, that's my small freelance company where I do programming projects or post educational content and lots of good fun stuff. Anyways. So the point of this talk is, I think those that might also be teachers of some sort. I teach college classes, but honestly, you could teach this to high schools and even, you know, junior high and so forth as well. I wouldn't see why not. So let's try to get into this. And also, it's not just for students. It could just be for those that are trying to find ways to explain, you know, with a little more force and understanding of what free software is and so forth. Okay, so who am I? Well, who are you? No, just joking. This is just a more of a joke slide kind of a situation in a sense. This is my bio. You might be familiar with it. This command of who am I? This is a common command you might use on a GNU/Linux system, which tells you what username you're logged into right now. But basically the bio, you can read, you know, lots of things up there. The main gist is I'm a full stack developer, deal with lots of different programming languages, Java, Python, PHP, web development, different databases, and And I teach currently as an assistant professor at Northern Virginia Community College. And I teach a variety of classes, such as a course on GNU/Linux. I'm currently teaching an advanced database management course, but I've also taught cybersecurity and so forth. My past, you could also just check out more details if you care on my website for some bio. But let's get into it. All right, so. Anyways, the concepts covered here is we're actually going to try to cover a lot of ground in a little, not as much time really, because normally when I go over these types of ideas, a subject, I do it usually within about 3 hours. So I'm going to try to do this in about 30, 35 minutes, because I'm also trying to leave some room for questions if you might have it, because I'll also be in the Freenode IRC channel on the hashtag LibrePlanet channel, and also the channel assigned for my speaking block. But anyhow, we're going to be going over what is copyright, patents, trademarks, and then eventually software licenses. And there's two broad categories, which is free software and proprietary. Now, I cover the others, copyright, patents, trademarks, just because a lot of people are mystified and like, oh, you got the patent on that, or da-da-da-da-da, when they talk about some sort of technology. And a lot of people don't know what they're really saying. It sounds, you know, like legalese or something like that, and they kind of give up at that stage. So let's try to make sense of all this. Okay, but legal disclaimer, I am not actually a lawyer. Okay, so if you want expert legal analysis, you know, hire a lawyer for your subject. However, it's, you know, I would bet money that most lawyers, even in the space, they don't actually understand free software licenses. So, anyhow, I'm going to try to make more sense of this. But what I based all of my ideas and so far on is from authoritative sources, and I've also just been in the free software world for many years, and I've been, you know, trying to understand this since the beginning. So let's begin. Why should you even care about copyrights, patents, and trademarks? Well, okay. So, in my opinion, now you might disagree with me, but I have come to the idea that these legal subjects are actually probably the most powerful forces in the world of business and technology. And as I list further, you can see I claim that with this knowledge, you can understand the technologies of the past and present. Probably you can predict the future as well. It sounds like you can understand all these technologies just by knowing what copyrights, patents, and trademarks are. It's like, actually, yes, because a lot of times organizations, companies, you know, developers, they just tell you how it works. You just have to know where to look where they tell you. And with that, the next bullet point is you actually can understand how entire organizations and industries think and how they operate, what makes them tick. They go to great lengths to explain what they think and why they care about it, but you just have to know where to read it. You don't even have to buy a book. It's on their website and so forth. And the other aspect too, especially if you're in the, you know, any aspect of the computing industry, such as a software developer, even like networking, cybersecurity, things like that, it's tough to figure out what to even study. So you can, by knowledge of this, you can oftentimes predict what's going to happen in the market. And with that in mind, another practical reason why you might even care is you might want to start your own technology business, like I did. and it's definitely helped me with this knowledge. But it's also, say, if you're, you want to, you know, you hear everyone wants to create their own app or game or website or something like that. Well, you want to understand these concepts, or else you can get in legal trouble. So, you don't want somebody suing all your money away, right? Okay. So, let's get into it. Let's explore copyright. What is it? What does it protect? How would you even get it? And how long does it last? All right. So, do you have any idea of what copyright even means? What about this? What is a copyright symbol? A lot of people do know this. Let's see if you do. What's your guess? That's right, I'm giving you a little bit of time to think. Yes, this is a copyright symbol. It's a C with a circle in it. So now you, when you see this symbol, which is everywhere, in so many places, you at least have some context that that's the copyright symbol. But what is copyright? Okay, so what I'm doing here is I'm quoting from an organization called the U.S. Copyright Office. And I'm not going to say every word here, but basically it protects a whole lot of things, such as a lot of artistic works, like images, graphics. It can even literally be a statue. Okay, it doesn't have to be on a piece of paper or a photograph. And it can protect other creative works like novels, you know, books, movies, poetry. And especially, you know, if you're like me, I love, you know, computer software or creating it and things of that nature. And it all falls under copyright. There's also, it says architecture, but it's kind of like talking about like blueprints and so forth. But the next paragraph that you see starting there is copyright doesn't actually protect an idea. It may seem like, well, why not? Why couldn't it protect an idea? Because it's a practical thing. It's like, how would you prove that you came up with that idea? You have to have some way to document it in some sort of a fashion. So with that in mind, how would you even get copyright protection? I assume you, right? You got to hire a lawyer to get this kind of protection. That sounds pretty advanced, right? Well, so we'll get to that. So as I mentioned, with this aspect, is that you need to have copyright in a fixed, tangible form. So it could be paper, it could be computer software, something that some person or some device could read. Okay, that is, it just needs to be fixed in some sort of state. It can't just be in your mind, because you have to have some way of proving that you created something. But once you have it in some sort of tangible form, guess what? It is instantly protected. I don't even care if you just take out a piece of paper right now and scribble scrabble, just make some sort of nonsense. It doesn't even have to look good. Congratulations. You now own the copyright to whatever you just did with the piece of paper and the pencil. Okay? Seriously, that's it. You don't have to do anything. Registration is not required. But the thing is, especially if you really, really care about this and you want to, you know, potentially try to sue other people in court or something like that, if they're trying to steal your stuff, is according to the U.S. Copyright Office, you need to register through them basically for this enhanced legal enforcement. So it's not like a one-day process. There's still an application you have to go through, so on and so forth, but not everybody goes through all that, those aspects, because nonetheless, you still own you still have copyright protection in a general sense. So they, you know, people can't just carte blanche start taking stuff from you. Now, how long do you think copyright protection lasts? I don't know, a couple of years, 5 years, something like that. No, actually, it lasts quite a long time. So in the case of this, like say your piece of paper, your masterpiece drawing that you might have created. Well, the copyright on that lasts for however long you live plus 70 years. Or, like, if there were two people involved in creating this, then
however long the last person lived, plus 70 years. So that's quite a long time, actually. And there's not really that, to my understanding, to try to renew it, there's potentially some ways to get around that, such as like digitally remastering something. But generally speaking, the original content that you created, there's a time table of when it expires for copyright protection. But there's also another category of kind of a time thing, as you can see there, is that, like, if you don't know who the author is, or so it's an anonymous work or a pseudo-anonymous work, meaning like it's a pen name, or say you work for a company. Oftentimes, you work for some sort of a company, you create something, the company wants to own that. You know, they want to have that that copyright. So there's different kind of rules. Basically, it's either 95 or 120 years. It's still a long time, even if it's 95 years, right? Okay, so let's give an example of this. Now, what you're looking at here is an amazing yet simple Java program that I created, okay? If you can understand my algorithm here, and you look at what I've created here, I am calculating the meaning of life. No, for real, I figured out a way to do that. It's quite simple, actually. It's joking. If you go through and actually run this program, it'll say at the end, it'll just say, the meaning of life is 42. It's just a joke. It comes from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is a you know, kind of a funny story where in it there's some folks that are asking this advanced computing device and ask, what is the meaning to life, the universe, and everything? And so then it goes through this process of coming up with an answer after millions and millions of years, and it comes back to be 42. It's just a joke. It doesn't mean much. But anyhow, so I created this program just so, because there's probably nobody else who've created exactly how I wrote my code with the kind of nonsense calculations here that I created. But the larger point is not to focus on the code. Okay, so I don't want you getting distracted by that. Actually, I want you to pay attention to the highlighted yellow portion that I have there. So what you'll notice is it starts out with a //. That's just because in programming code, this is referred to as a comment, meaning it's not actually part of the code, so I can just, it's just freeform text. So in this case, I am clearly indicating that I am claiming copyright on this code. So I'm saying that copyright and the little copyright symbol, that I'm stating that I created this in the year 2019 by William Paul Leggett, which is me. The thing though is, okay, now let's, what about this situation? If we found this code just posted on the internet somewhere, it could just be on some sort of a forum, it could just be wherever, okay? Say it's not even on my website, it's just somewhere. And you see this code, and it looks interesting, so you want to run it. Or use it, change it, you know. So that's the question, could you use it? Could you just take it and, I know you could copy paste, I get that. But I'm saying, like, is there any issue with doing that? You know, could I get mad at you or something like that? I mean, it's on the internet, right? So like, I assume you probably could run this, correct? No, that's the thing. No, in the current form of this, you would actually have to ask me to run this program. I know you technically could very quickly copy and paste this code, compile it, and run the program. But legally speaking, you actually need to contact me because I am claiming copyright on this code. All right. But let's go to another example. The thing is, though, the code is exactly the same, so don't worry about that. The scenario is different. Okay, so in this case, I don't even have the copyright kind of notice in there. So it just says, you know, by William Paul Liggett. So what about now? Like, obviously, like, this is, it seems like a little less intimidating. Sure, what's the harm now, right? We probably could use it, post it on the internet, da-da-da-da-da. No, that's the thing. Copyright protection is automatic, okay? Even if the person doesn't understand this, okay? Even if they could maybe figure out this later, okay? So the thing is, you still would need permission from the author who created the code, all right? Again, this is just to protect yourself legally, all right? Now, okay, last example. This one is pretty interesting, actually. Okay, here we go. It's the same code. Okay, it's the exact same code. The thing is, it's just code. You don't even know who created this. Say it's just posted wherever, all right? Maybe it's written on a piece of paper. I don't even, you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be posted on the internet. It could just be wherever. Could you just use this code? Like, you know, just, again, I know you can copy-paste the code. But what I'm saying is, what's the harm now, right? Because you don't even know who did what. Who's, right? Like, who's going to come after you, kind of a thing. No. You still cannot use this. I know you're thinking, like, what? Oh, that's ridiculous. Yes, because, look, copyright protection is automatic, and it lasts for either 95 or 120 years for anonymous works. In this case, this is an anonymous work. We don't know who created it. Huh? You see how this applies now? All right. Now, let's talk about patents. Okay, what is it, and what does it protect? Same gist as what we covered with copyright, right? How do you get it, so on and so forth. Now, due to time constraints, I'm actually going to speed this up a bit, okay? But I just want to explore this a little bit just so you have a bit of orientation to what that even means, why is it different than copyright and so forth. What about this? This should be an easy one. What is the patent symbol, right? If copyright, right, remember that was a C with a circle, patent is probably a P in a circle, right? No. You don't want a P in a circle. Just joking. All right, so it's actually a trick question. There's actually no symbol for a patent. You'll just see actually just text phrases such as patent pending, or actually a U.S. patent number, da-da-da-da-da. That's an actual patent right there. The D604305, that's the patent to Apple for a grid of colorful icons, which, yeah, I talk a little bit later. Basically, especially with the patent pending, they're just, a company is just letting other, you know, especially other companies know that, hey, this is our turf. Like, don't try to mess with this. If you do, you gotta watch out, kind of a situation. But what is a patent and what does it protect? Well, okay, so this is what I'm doing here is I'm actually quoting from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, which is another government entity. According to them, they claim it's a patent is an invention that's a grant of a property right to the inventor issued by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Now, there's actually three kinds of patents. Most people, especially myself, to me, I mainly, you know, are mostly interested in the utility patents. That's what most people think about, because that's talking about something new and useful, like a new and useful machine or object or some sort of an improvement on some existing object. So you think about Alexander Graham Bell, how he was awarded the patent for creating the telephone, and that was a very useful device. You know, a lot of people use phones these days. But then you get these other areas of patent law where it's like design patents, and especially this plant patents. It's kind of ridiculous to me. But, you know, that's some good lobbying efforts, I assume, by Monsanto and so forth, where, yes, you can literally get a patent to grow a new plant, which I find a little ridiculous, since you're patenting a life form. Circling back to the number two listed one, there's this aspect called a design patent. It's kind of this weird area of patent law where you can actually get awarded, according to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, some sort of a abstract property right just for coming up with a new kind of design for an object. Okay, so it's not even the object, it's just a design for the object. Anyhow, how would you even get a patent? Do you need to register? Do you need to hire a lawyer? What I'm asking is, it's similar to copyright, where once you create it, you just get it? No. Unfortunately, you actually do have to go through a very lengthy registration process. And if you make it all the way through, you get the patent, you know, or if not, you're halfway there, patent pending, and so forth. But it's kind of, so with it, it's an interesting idea, really, because a patent is that an inventor, say, of a device, they actually have to explain how that device works, okay? And when they do that, and they're giving it to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, when that inventor gets that device, you know, that patent for that device, that is actually public knowledge now. It's not hidden. American, you know, taxpayers, they've already paid for that. So they can read all the ins and outs of the patent application, so they can understand how that device works. It's not supposed to be a mystery, okay? The trade-off, though, is that the inventor basically gets a monopoly for quite a long time on that technology. So on one hand, the inventor is, you know, educating the world. On the other hand, they then also get a monopoly. So that's basically the idea of what a patent is all about. You know, how long does a patent last? In this case, it's not quite as long as copyright, but it's for 20 years. Now, that's still quite a long time to just have a lock on the market. And you could potentially compete with other patented technology, I suppose. It would just have to be different and, you know, substantially different aspects that the original person who was granted the patent couldn't, you know, try to come after the other competitor and so forth. Now, let's move on to the idea of trademarks. I just mentioned this because it's part of this space, and, you know, it's like somebody saying, oh, did you trademark your code or something like that? You want to just have an idea of why that's incorrect and so forth. So the basic idea with trademarks, okay, what is it, how does it protect, so on and so forth. Let's go to this, though. What is the trademark symbol? You might be thinking the TM, or maybe the registered R mark, right? Hopefully, maybe you've gotten those two. Did you know there's actually three of them? Yes. There's three different symbols. A lot of people are not familiar with the SM mark, but it does exist if you look for it in the right place. Anyways, I'll explain those a little later. So what is a trademark and what does it protect? So a trademark, it's basically trying to identify where a product comes from. Like, if somebody sells a product, it's not so much their trademarking the product itself, they're actually just they're trademarking like their brand name and so forth. Okay, so I mean, maybe the product has a brand name to it, but that's more the concept is. So it's like Pizza Hut versus Domino's. Okay, that both can sell pizza. That's not doesn't mean if Domino's gets the trademark to their logo, like both places can sell pizza, but what they don't want to do is, say, if I go and buy pizza from Domino's, that I then go and take it out of their box and put it into my box under, you know, junk text pizza or something like that. And that's where Domino's is going to get mad and like, hey, whoa, that's our stuff. You're messing with our brand. You know, you don't try to claim you're creating our stuff. Okay, that's where they're going to get mad. So that's basically the idea. So it could be a word, a phrase, or symbol, or design, or combination, or whatnot. And as you can also read there, there's a service mark is exactly the same thing as a trademark. It's just a different type of business, okay? Because what you're doing is you're identifying a source of a service rather than goods or like physical products, okay? So how would you get a trademark? This is where it depends. For general purpose aspects, you really don't have to do much for either claiming the TM or SM little symbol that you might see in a lot of products. A lot of products you'll see either TM or at least the registered R. Those are very, very common. But regardless, for TM or the SM, you don't have to register through anything. It does actually have legal protection, but you have to basically earn that protection over time. And hopefully nobody comes and claims like, oh, wait a minute, that's my trademark or whatever. With a registered mark, it's much more of a process, it's much more thorough, and you know, you go through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and it applies to both trademarks or service marks. Here's some examples. So on the left-hand side, you see the Starbucks logo. What I find interesting is they're still using TM, the TM aspects. They didn't even go through the process to register it. I guess they just figure it's so common, no one's really using it. They're going to spend their lawyers to do other things. But if you might be familiar with, say, Easy Pass, I would actually notice this. Their older signs would actually say, with a little SM, if you see in the right-hand corner of the logo, on the top one. Nowadays, though, you'll actually see the registered R mark, because they've actually gone through the process. But the reason why it's more of a service is, you know, if you buy, to use Easy Pass, you have to get a little transponder for your car. Sure, you have to buy the transponder and so forth, but that's not why you're paying Easy Pass. You know, that's not why you're giving money to Easy Pass to get the little transponder physical box thing. No, you want to be able to skip traffic when it's busy, and you're going to pay them a little bit more money to go to the HOV three lanes and whatnot. Okay, so you're getting the service rather than physically, you know, some product like coffee from Starbucks. How long does a trademark last? So it actually can last basically forever. It doesn't necessarily last forever. It's just that if the product or your business is still in service, it can basically keep going for as long as you need it. Registered marks are a little bit different. There's a little more stipulations. You watch out for different filing things. I have it listed there. It's like, long story short, if you basically have to renew at least every 10 years and so forth. So that's basically the summary in that regard. Now, this is actually, unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time to go into any of this, but I highly recommend, if you're not aware, you should definitely look into these aspects, because they tie into all of these concepts. So going back to the original point, why would you even care about this subject? Well, you care because it's actually your world. It's like you don't even understand, you don't realize how all over this these laws apply to you and how weird they can get. So especially like the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and it can get kind of crazy with what industry likes to call digital rights management, DRM. But folks like myself and others, we like to mock that and say it's actually more about digital restrictions management. Definitely looking at that. I don't have time to go into it. Other aspects, anti-piracy laws, like lawmakers worried about people stealing copyrighted work and selling it and so forth. The problem, though, is even though they might have good intentions to create laws to prevent that technically if they were actually implemented, it would basically be a form of censorship. You could shut an entire site down if there was one copyright, suspected copyright violation and so forth. Another good one is, you know, basically confusing legal agreements to collect lots of data on you. Such as like Facebook, they use emotional intelligence, so EQ type technology to know what your emotional state is at all times. Like, so an actual patent that I'm listing here, is they're capturing passive image data. So literally they're recording your face and detecting your emotional state every millisecond. So it's a little, you know, it sounds a little spooky, but it's not hidden. This is actually, it's an actually awarded patent. It's not like some theoretical thing that they're working on. So, you know, that's why you might want to care about this subject. And then another thing that I critique is, you know, patents for very simple ideas, like a grid of colorful icons awarded to Apple, which Samsung had to pay $539 million to, which is ridiculous to me, because it's like, well, I don't really consider a grid of colorful icons to be the same intellectual ingenuity as the invention of the telephone. It's not even on the same territory. Anyways, I gotta move on though. Now we're finally into the territory of understanding what software licenses, why they even come up. Because as you saw practically, you can't do really anything with software, code, or the program unless you've been told you could, okay? And that's a license. That's what that's all about. And it all falls under copyright laws, okay? So a software license, it's a legal agreement that explains what you can or cannot do with the software. It's like when you see the aspect of, you know, da-da-da, these terms and conditions. Well, I know most people don't read the terms and conditions, but you should, because they're telling you all the rules of what you supposedly must follow forevermore. Okay? So that's what this is all about. The only thing is, there's two broad categories of software licenses. On one hand, there is a category called free software, which again is not about $0. It's not about paying. It's not about just not paying for software, because it's more about different kinds of lots of freedoms that come with that aspect. But then on the other side, there is what's referred to as proprietary. To summarize these two areas, it really boils down to freedom. Okay, so on the free software aspect, you'll notice how it starts with freedom to, and it says freedom to, like number zero, it starts at zero. Okay, it's programming humor, that if you're a programmer, you'd get the joke. That there's four freedoms here. The zeroth freedom is that you are allowed to run the software, which is pretty powerful, actually, because for instance, if you're using a software called LibreOffice, which is like Microsoft Office. A lot of people have heard of Microsoft Office, but LibreOffice is free software. You can download it, and it comes with all of these freedoms and so forth. And what that means is you could run that software on any and every computer you might care about. You don't have to, like, pay for more aspects. I know in LibreOffice you don't have to pay anything. That's not the point. It's more the freedoms that come along with this. But on the other hand, on the proprietary side, Microsoft Office, you buy one, you know, you can only install it on one computer, kind of a situation. But then there's other things, like especially if you're, you know, care about code and things like that. How does it work? Free software, you're allowed to study and modify the code, which is also huge. You know, if you are concerned about surveillance issues and things like that, you can really have more trust built in to really make sure, how does this actually work? And then you can redistribute, you can like, give it to others. If you modify it, you can also redistribute. There's stipulations you have to stick to, but these freedoms are built in. Proprietary, there's no guaranteed freedoms. They might have here and there stuff, but you really have to read what's referred to as their end user license agreement, the EULA. Okay, it's literally read through this long legal agreement thing. They're telling you what you can and can't do. Most proprietary software traditionally is you are not allowed to see the code, and there's other restrictions. You can't run it on, you know, more than one computer, things of that nature. Now, there's maybe kind of a relatable concept, moving on to a different subject, that it's a term called freeware. It's not as popular, the phrase of that, anymore, but it's still, the concept still exists. Freeware is like if you download software for, you know, you didn't pay anything and you could just use it. You know, think of some sort of an app or whatever. The thing is, a lot of people think, well, of course, that's free software. No. Freeware traditionally is over in the proprietary area. You could use it maybe for free, but they don't want you to know how it works, and so forth. Likewise, there's another concept called like trialware. You know, you could use a software for 30 days and then you have to pay for it, but again, it falls into proprietary. This is also, you know, as you saw earlier, that if code has no license, it doesn't tell you, it just says maybe copyright or buy something, you actually can't do anything with it. Like, you can't even run it. You're not supposed to. You have to wait for some legal agreement to let you know what you can or can't do. So watch out for that. Put some sort of a license on software. Now, moving over into the free software space, there's a little bit of confusion because there's lots and lots of free software licenses, okay? But it's basically broken down into two broad categories. There's copyleft and permissive. Copyleft, what that idea is all about, is the built-in freedoms that you see above, you know, the four freedoms that are there. You're not allowed to take away those freedoms, okay? But the permissive, it's a little more loosey-goosey. It's like, you know, this, we got these freedoms, it's how they initially come, but, you know, you could change it if you want later, kind of a thing. That's basically the gist between the two. But with, say, copyleft, again, the freedoms must remain, that there's actually two categories of copyleft. There's strong copyleft and weak copyleft. Now, to give you some practical examples of actual licenses, okay, so like the GNU/Linux operating system, that is under the GPL, which the GPL part stands for the General Public License, but it created by an organization called GNU, so it's the GNU General Public License. And so these freedoms you cannot take away, they are built in, and there's other aspects, so it's a very strong form of making sure that free software remains free software, okay? There's even, I'm a big fan of what's referred to as the AGPL, which is the GNU Afero GPL. So especially with so many aspects with the web connected technologies, web applications, so forth, the AGPL addresses, you know, having code run on a network server, and it has a more enhanced form of the GPL in that regard. But let me go into the weak copyleft, what that's about. Weak copyleft, these are just some examples, I'm just saying. There's what's referred to as the lesser GPL, which is popular for like different types of libraries and things like that. If you're not a programmer, it's basically like other capabilities that other people have created. It might be in the lesser GPL license. Or similar, there's the MPL 2.0, the what Mozilla uses, say, like for the Firefox web browser, they use the MPL. Weak copyleft, it's kind of this middle zone between strong copyleft and the permissive side. So the freedoms remain where the portion of your code, of what you created, like of what is falls under the license, it's going to stay with those freedoms. It's going to remain that license generally. But you can do some aspects where it can maybe not be too intense with certain aspects interacting with proprietary aspects. All right. Now, then with the permissive side, here are some example licenses. Again, there's a lot more licenses than this, but I'm just picking a few of them. So a popular permissive style license is the Apache license 2.0. And it's very permissive. It's, so the code is free. You can see it and so forth. Again, free as in zero. It doesn't have to be $0. You could actually have to pay for it. But you can, if you want to, somebody else could basically turn that code proprietary if they wanted. Or it can also go the other way. It could go into the copyleft zone too. All right. Now let me show you a more visual way of understanding all this, more visual summary. That, let's say, start on the proprietary side. That over there, proprietary, say this is what I'm saying is this big red block. Say that's like a proprietary program, okay, a game. Well, you don't know what you can do with it. You just have to read the end user license agreement, the EULA, and that's basically it. But if you move over to the permissive side, say something like the BSD 3 clause, okay, that's another license, like the Apache one. Well, if you wanted to, that all of that code can instantly be turned into a proprietary program. You have to attribute who created the original program and, you know, have a copy of the original license. But for the most part, you don't have to keep the code as free software anymore. In effect, this is basically how Apple does most of its business model, is they get a lot of things from like the free BSD project, and then they basically rename it to be called macOS. You know, they make it look nice and stuff like that too. But that's what can happen in the BSD side, the permissive side. But it can also become copyleft as well. So it's very permissive. You see how that works? With weak copyleft, say you have a proprietary program, okay, and you could actually embed, for instance, with the MPL, you can put that MPL portion, like that capability, inside of the proprietary program, but the MPL code zone has to remain free software. So it's kind of like a DMZ zone. Like, that will always remain open. You can't turn it to be so it's not free software anymore. But if you look at the strong copyleft, look at what's going on here. What I'm saying is you can't directly intermingle a proprietary program and, you know, have it directly use, build in some GPL code. It's not allowed, because then what you're basically doing is a user who wants to see the program, you know, like it just doesn't allow for that type of a situation. Just the license agreement, it says, you know, you can have a GPL code running on the same computer as there might be a proprietary program as well, but they can't be basically combined, like, directly, like that proprietary program relies on the GPL technology to work. Because if it does, then the proprietary program is, congratulations, it's now into, it will have to be, it will have to adopt the GPL license. You know, in my opinion, that's a great thing. But that's the situation in that regard. So an example of how you actually do this is, for instance, the GNU Aferl GPL is you take basically, you need to, the best practice is put in every source code file all of your code, like before you see the code, you put this at the top, like so you explain what your program is, copyright by, year, and who you are, and then in the blue there, that's the actual, like, kind of a summary form of the license, and there's a larger, to actually get the license, what you do is you do this. What I reckon, one of the easiest ways, there's different ways to go about this, is you could just download, say, the GPL or AGPL license from GNU's website, download it to the program which will, you know, be distributed to others in like the main program directory, and then you could rename it that file to something like, you know, copying. You could keep it as a web file, so copying.html or license.html. You could still reference it as AGPL or something like that too, but you want to be clear what the legal agreement is. So that's basically the gist of, you know, how to understand free software versus proprietary software licenses. Any questions? All right. And please keep in touch, and I'll address your questions in the IRC channel. You can find me, see my website and so forth. But yeah, please keep in touch. I'd like to hear more from you, and I hope you learned a lot.